So the first part of this afternoon is going to be tech, and more tech. Really, it can be really, really overwhelming, right? You know that you want to do digital humanities. You know that you have a project that probably is going to require some sort of digital component to be most effective. You want to use digital methodologies. Where do you begin from a tech perspective? What options are out there? What do you need to think about when you are choosing the technology that you're going to that you're going to use? What different factors do you need to keep in the back of your mind? And some of this we kind of glossed over yesterday when we were talking about getting started. Today we're going to go into it in a little bit more detail, talking about the various issues that might come up. So the very first thing that you have to do when you're embarking on something along these lines is evaluate your needs. Okay, basically, what is it that you want to do? And the answer to that question is really going to define a lot of what comes next for you. There is absolutely no point looking at text analysis tools if what you're interested in doing is creating a virtual exhibit of 19th century quilts that were made in Scotland. That's probably not going to get you very far. So you need to very obviously look for the types of tools that will best fit the needs of your the needs and goals of your project. Second major concern that you're going to have is, what is your budget? You know, is this something that needs to be inexpensive, or do you have the funds to either develop something from scratch or potentially to purchase a commercial solution? The digital humanities community is, as we've kind of alluded to, very committed to the open source community, open source ethos. But as Jen demonstrated before lunch with Basecamp, sometimes there's no point in reinventing the wheel. If there is a commercial product that does exactly what you need it to do, but that you have to pay for, as long as that's within the scope of your budget, that's worth pursuing. The other factor of that, of course, is that if there's a commercial product, the cost of replicating that, if you choose to go out and develop something on your own that is doing basically the same functionality, is probably not going to be very cost-effective for you. Even a piece of software that costs $1,000 for a annual license is considerably cheaper than the cost of hiring a programmer to go out and develop or use tools. So you need to evaluate all of the different options that are available for you, ranging from the free open source ones to expensive commercial ones. Different tools will fit different needs. Next question you have to ask is, who is going to be the primary user? Again, this is going to really define what types of tools and products you're going to be using and creating. If the purpose of your project is for you as an individual to be able to conduct sophisticated analyses of large data sets, then you're going to look at very different types of tools to those that the intended purpose is to educate and inform the public. They're going to be very different in terms of what you can do with access to the command line interface. It's much more reasonable to expect you yourself to learn programming than it is for someone who is visiting your website to learn programming to be able to access what you're doing. So you need to make sure that the tools that you use are appropriate to the audience and the primary users. And different stages of your project will require different answers to that question. So that also means that you will be using different tools and different types of tool at different stages of of the project. Next thing to do is to do an environmental scan and find out whether or not someone has done something similar. As I said before, there's no point reinventing the wheel. Oftentimes, you'll find that there is an existing tool that will do 75% of what you want to do. And if that's the case, go ahead and use it. And you will be able to develop strategies as you're going for what works, what doesn't work within the context of your specific research question. You'll be able to think through what you might be able to do to improve it. You are going to be able to potentially connect with that developer or with that project team and group your efforts together. You might be able to extend their project in ways that they never anticipated to the benefit of both of you. And that's a very cost-effective way of going about it. The very last question that you should be asking yourself is, do I have to build something myself from scratch? That is, in a lot of ways, the case of last resort for digital humanities projects, especially for projects for people who are new to the field. If you find yourself proposing that you're going to develop a project and you're working from literally zero lines of existing code, take a big step back and re-ask all of these questions for yourself. It might very well be that you do need to develop something from scratch, but you don't need to take that step unless it is absolutely necessary. And oftentimes you will find that when you're writing your proposal to the National Endowment for the Humanities or whomever it is, the ability to say that you have used and evaluated existing tools and these are the gaps that you see in them will make your case all that stronger for getting funding to develop your own tools. So what I'm really, really stressing here is take your time. Don't rush into anything. And just be confident that you have looked into as many options as you can before you kind of take that leap. Because the decisions that you make at this point, they're not irreversible. But if you get 6 months down the line and you suddenly discover that, oh, I'm using this database system and it doesn't export the data in the format that I need it to be in at the end of the day, that's not a good situation to be, and I'm speaking from personal experience here because I have a big data set that is locked in a proprietary format that is very difficult to get to now get it out of. So learn from learn from those types of experiences for sure. But taking the time up front to really clearly evaluate what it is that you want to be able to do with the project, with the tools that you might need, will help you avoid making those mistakes. So where do you find this, all of these tools? Google is oftentimes the first starting point for a lot of people. If you do use Google, use it very carefully. You will often find that the results that Google will spit out at you will not be at all relevant, or they will favor commercial vendors. Oftentimes, because digital humanities likes to use pithy, clever names for their projects, you will type in, you'll have heard of this vague tool called Mallet, and you'll type in Mallet in Google, and you'll get a lot of links to hammers, which might be a nice might sum up your experiences trying to use some of these tools, but isn't relevant. So you need to be very careful. And just because it shows up in Google and just because it shows up high in the Google rankings doesn't necessarily mean that it is a tool that is widely used within the digital humanities community. It just means that they've got people that know how to fudge those Google page ranking results. a much better place to look is within the digital humanities literature, where people have published and discussing tools. Venues like DH Quarterly, which is a journal, Digital Humanities Now, which we talked about earlier in terms of your publicity in Twitter, conference and workshop proceedings, and even recent books are all potential places where people who are practitioners in the field are talking about and disseminating the projects that they are doing. The proviso, of course, with books is that books take, what, 2-3 years to publish, oftentimes from first submission of your proposal to actual publication date. So this is a very fast moving field in a lot of ways. So books can be outdated much more quickly than you expect, and much more quickly than is common in other humanities disciplines. So the best place to look is obviously going to be, is likely to be these three digital, the journals, networking sites like Digital Humanities Now, conference and workshop proceedings. You might also look at things like the HNET discussion list. There's an HNET list called AHC, which I got an email today saying they were changing their name to Digital History, which I suspect is going to be very controversial.
Just a little bit. Which one's
going to
be now?
It's not on here.
Oh, it's on
It's not HNET.
HNET's not going to be...
No. You guys all know what HNET is, right? Okay, HNET is a online discussion group, mailing list, book review site that's run out of Michigan State.
Yes.
It's h-net.org, and they have discussion lists for all sorts of different topics. It's not limited to the digital humanities by any stretch. There's a list for... there's H Civil War, there's H South, there's H Africa, H Britain,
grad list.
Yes. It's aimed primarily at historians, or at least it originally was aimed primarily at historians. It's kind of branched out now. There is one of the lists is called HAHC, which was H Association for History and Computing, something like that. But as I say, they actually just sent an email out literally this morning saying that they were changing their name to H Digital History. That is a discussion board where people post questions and other people within the community answer them. So that's a great place, hey, I'm interested in looking at using topic modeling to explore this. Where would be a great? Could anyone recommend a place to start? And you'll oftentimes get a response within 2 or 3 days, just depending on how active the list editor is about reposting replies. So another place for finding tools is the NEH Office of Digital Humanities. Their website has a list of all of the funding that they have given since probably 2005 and beyond. So you can go in there and you can see what types of projects they have given money to, what types of tools they have funded. One of the general requirements of NEH funding is that those tools are open source and are accessible to the broader community. So it's a great way to see what other people have been doing. As we discussed this morning, they maintain a library of all of the white papers that successful grantees have created at the end of the products, at the end of the grant funding period. So you can understand the process that they went through to go from the initial concept and the initial granting of money to some form of final product, whether that final product was a success or not. And they will generally outline the types of user that is that they anticipate using their tools, and links to where the source code is and that sort of thing. And the final thing I put on here was Bamboo Dirt, which we talked about yesterday. I actually have a slide on it, so I'm not going to rehash that because we did that in at quite some length. So, probably the best maxim that you can have is do not use a cannon to kill a mosquito. Okay? There is absolutely no point in using the world's most powerful tool to do a relatively simple digital humanities project. So you don't need to commit yourself to using something that requires a lot of resources, that requires a team of system administrators to maintain it, if you are the only user. So pick technologies that are appropriate to the use, to your goals and your aims. So, questions that you should be asking yourself: can you maintain the technology yourself? Basically, what that means is this something that will sit on your hard drive in your office computer, and you're only going to turn to it every so often? Or is it going to require that team of system administrators? Is it going to require a team of programmers? Does my technology require long-term investments? Is this something that you can basically do right now with what you have available to yourself? Or is it going to require some of your team members to be reallocated 20% of their time so that they can work on developing your tool? Is that something that you can sustain? Is that something that you are going to be required to buy a stack of servers? What are the long-term infrastructural, both technical and personnel, that you are going to be required to make by your choice of technology? Finally, am I overestimating my team's experience with a particular technology? Just because I say that I am the world's expert in R does not necessarily mean that I am the world's expert in R. So what that really means is know the skill sets surrounding you, know their limitations, and those might be technical limitations or they might be time limitations. Now, both Jen and I are generally pretty overcommitted when it comes to our time. The notion of a 40-hour week for us, I suspect, is...
joke.
I was going to go with laughable, but joke works. And I'm sure that's the case for pretty much everyone here. So when we say my team's experience with a particular technology, it's not just their familiarity with it, what their learning curve might be. It's also whether or not they actually have the time in their existing schedules to be able to adopt that technology, to learn that technology, and to implement that technology.
I think it's a good idea, too, to like roll this back to this morning's discussions about partners and knowing your partners and their personalities and the types of work they like to do and the skills they can bring to it is a key thing. If you have people or technologies that require, a coder to be out in front all the time talking to people, and personality-wise, they're more comfortable sitting behind the scenes and not being engaged with the public or not being engaged with people in certain ways, you want to take that into account. If you have people that are shy or it takes them longer to learn things, you don't want to place them in situations where all of the technical deliverables are relying on them getting to things super quickly. So thinking through how people like to work and not just sort of their time or their skill set, but also, is this someone that may need extra time to implement something? Or is this somebody that can implement it super fast, but doesn't always do the detail work? of checking to make sure it's been done correctly the first time and they've done all the things that we needed them to do.
Okay, so some examples. Okay, say you're interested in doing topic modeling. We've used that phrase a lot in the last 2 days. I think this is the last time we will. you'll all be pleased to hear. But this is an example of three different ways in which you can think about how you might go about doing topic modeling based on your comfort with both programming, with your the data that you have, the time that you have, what your projected outcomes are. So one way of doing topic modeling is with a piece of software called the Topic Modeling GUI, which is actually a piece of JavaScript that was developed at
Yale.
I was going to say Princeton. Yeah. And it provides a very user-friendly front end. So it's basically an interface that allows you to click a button and select the directory where your data is stored. It allows you to very quickly put in various variables that topic modeling relies on to produce an output, and it will automatically spew out a set of results that you can then look at and you can play with in various other pieces of software. The Topic Modeling GUI is a fantastic piece of software for someone who is just getting started with this, or if you have a relatively limited data set, or if you know that you're only going to need to run this type of thing over a short period of time. In other words, you don't need to invest you don't need to invest very much time in learning how to use this, learning how to access the results and things like that. On the other hand, Mallet, which actually the Topic Modeling GUI is a front end for, Mallet requires you to interact with the software at the command line level, which means that in order to get any sort of results from it, you have to type in lines of code that very specifically tell the software what you want, where your data is collected. The advantage of using Mallet at the command line level is that you have the power to do a lot of things that the topic modeling GUI doesn't do. So you can you can create custom types of output that aren't available through the GUI. You can do more sophisticated types of analysis. You can actually, it's more effective at working with larger data sets, and perhaps more crucially, it's scalable so that you can run it on high-performance computing and parallelized resources, which you don't need to worry about. But the point is that this is a tool that you might use if you are planning to be engaged with topic modeling over a sustained period of time. It's worth the time and effort to you as a researcher to become familiar with the underpinnings of Mallet, to understand how it works so that you can get the best results for your problem. The third solution is a custom LDA solution written in R, which sounds like quite the mouthful. What that basically means is that you have rewritten Mallet yourself. You have taken the algorithms that they have done, and you have tweaked them, you've customized them, so that you are creating your own custom output that really, really, really suits the specific requirements of your project. If you're at all familiar with a guy at Illinois called Ted Underwood, this is what he does, this is what he's writing about. For 99.9% of humanists, this third step is overkill. But if you are interested in a very specific data set, a very specific type of data, or a very specific type of result coming out of it, it is, again, probably worth your time to invest in creating something that will do what you want it to do, and do it repeatedly so that you are able to massage the results. And then the same principles apply across the digital humanities. So spatial analysis. You can do some really, really good digital humanities spatially based projects that rely solely on Google Maps, Google Earth as a front end. They require a very low investment of time, a very low investment of money because they're hosted by Google. And they allow you to conduct relatively straightforward analyses. They allow you to embed levels of information within them. They work really, really well for the vast majority of digital humanities projects. But sometimes that isn't enough. So you might look at WorldMap. WorldMap is an open source tool that allows you to do things like overlay census data on a map and then statistically analyze it so that you can make conclusions about the relationship between population density and poverty at a congressional district level, something along those lines. Again, there is more of a learning curve here, but the user interface is relatively straightforward. It's hosted in the cloud by the people that do WorldMap if you want, so you don't have to invest in expensive servers or expensive software. But sometimes you need the power of something like Esri ArcGIS, which, for those of you who don't know, is the industry standard for geospatial data, geospatial presentation. It's the piece of software that the U.S. government uses. It's used across the world. It's very expensive. But the good news with it is that a lot of universities actually have site licenses. So if you're fortunate enough to be at an institution that has that, it is available for free to you. But again, the investment that you need to be able to use it effectively, to take advantage of the power that is embedded within that piece of software, might not be necessary for what you are trying to do. If all you want to do is highlight on the map the location of EPSCoR states in the United States, use Google Maps. If you want to do something that allows you to compare the population density of EPSCoR states versus the amount of federal funding that EPSCoR states receive, then something like ArcGIS is going to be much more appropriate. So the message I'm trying to give you is use a tool that is appropriate to the level of investment that you need to make to get what you want out of it. If in doubt, play. You know, just go into these software packages. We talked about this a little bit when we were going through Bamboo Dirt. Click on those links, see what looks interesting, see what you are comfortable with. To give you an example, which is in no way related to the digital humanities, I use a piece of software called Scrivener. Is anyone familiar with Scrivener? Yeah, I love Scrivener. It exactly suits the way in which I think about writing. But it's not for everyone. Someone else might use OhmWriter. Does anyone use OhmWriter? Anyone familiar with that? Nessus? Microsoft Word. I know the differences between those four pieces of software because I have actually spent time sitting with them, playing with them, working with them. As another example, who uses Zotero? Who hates Zotero? I loathe it. I can't stand it. But I can say that from having spent time with it, I know that it doesn't fit into my workflow. It doesn't fit into the way in which I think. It doesn't fit into the way in which I like to interact with my references. It also doesn't play particularly nicely with Scrivener. So that was another big part in it. But the point is, you won't know unless you actually try. You won't know what's important. You won't know what's important to you. So there are two ways of going about it. The first way is to start with some of those basic looking tools and play with them and see if it does what you want you to do. And if you hit up against a wall where suddenly the functionality isn't meeting what you need, that's the point at which you know that you need to start thinking about something a bit more advanced. The other way is to jump into the deep end, start playing with Mallet, and see where you end up. I don't recommend that necessarily, not necessarily specifically to Mallet, but oftentimes, my experience working with people is that oftentimes they become very quickly overwhelmed by these things, and they give up. And that's unfortunate, because what they can do is they can ask the community. Us DH folks are really friendly, for the most part. We're really eager to help, for the most part. and we aren't going to tell you that that's a silly question, for the most part. So, common errors that you might make. And these are kind of specific to web building type things, but they are, and programming. Building custom websites using HTML, CSS, and Java Query. Basically, if you're doing all of that, it means that no one but yourself knows how the thing works. And that can be a real problem if the hypothetical bus hits you. Because suddenly someone has invested thousands of dollars in you creating a tool, and there is no documentation, there is very little chance of being able to reverse engineer what you have done so that someone else can reconstruct it. And it's not just a question of that being important from the context of you might get hit by a bus. It's important from the question of other people in the community being able to use and understand your tool. The solution with that is to use open source materials, is to use open standards. There are a lot of sites that will guide you through the process of identifying that. Ideally, your lead programmer, when you're working on a collaboration, will be the point person who will ensure all of this. Your role as a project is the project lead or as the project manager is to ask the questions. Right? You don't need to know necessarily what the difference is between HTML, CSS, and jQuery. What you need to know is that if he or she is using custom jQuery, that might be an issue, and you need to understand why that decision has been made and talk to him or her about how you would go about making it more standards compliant. Next bullet point is having stale content that requires hand corrections updating. You know, as we talked about this morning, there is nothing worse than having to go into an HTML page and having to hand code it so that it's in italics, or hand code it so that you're changing it from being an object to a frame. If you work with tools like Drupal with WordPress, then you are able to do this on the fly. You're able to do it in a way that is user-friendly, that you can make these changes more or less instantaneously with very little margin for error. And the advantage of using tools like WordPress and Drupal is that they actually have built-in functionality that allow you to do some of the more advanced HTML, CSS encoding if you want to. So you can, in Drupal, there is a button that you can click on that on the page that Jen was showing you, where you turn off rich text. And what that does is it shows you the raw HTML code. So you still have that option available to you if you need it. For reference, that's precisely how I did all of the PDFs on the site, because the way in which they're embedded requires HTML code that Drupal by default will actually strip out. So Drupal in particular, if you put in HTML code beyond basic things, it will delete it for you. It will just go away unless you tell it not to. And that's for security issues of a whole variety of things. And then the final issue to think about is you don't want to be the person that has to approve everything. If you have a big project, that can very, very quickly overwhelm your inbox. It can very, very quickly overwhelm your time. If every single piece of code, piece of information has to be filtered through a single person, it creates a bottleneck in your time in the project. So delegate responsibility to people who you trust, to people who are appropriate for it, so that technical approvals go through your lead programmer. Press releases go through your project director, that sort of thing. But just ensure that you are not the sole bottleneck that might potentially hold up the entire project if you happen to go on vacation for 5 days unexpectedly.